Welcome to Follow the Sound, This Week in Music History. I am your host, Brian Kroc. Each week, we try to bring you different aspects of the music world. And of course, this one is music history. And to help me along with this is my good friend, Jacob Grum.
You can talk to God, listen to the casual reply. I've seen it raining fire in the sky.
And of course, Greg Harvey.
Glad to be here.
So I feel like, guys, we've been having a good run so far, right?
If by run you mean running long, yes.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, we've had a couple of really, really long episodes, but that's fine. That's, you know, that's neither here nor there. But I think we really got this sucker in a groove, and we're doing quite well. But we can do better, all right? And people can help us do better by going to our website at followthesoundpodcast.com and clicking on the Amazon banner. If you click on the Amazon banner, it takes you to Amazon. You can do all of your normal shopping, just like anybody would do on Amazon, and you can buy practically everything on Earth on Amazon. I don't know why you would want to buy some of those things, but, you know, who am I to judge? So go buy them. It won't cost you anything extra if you go through our link, but we get a little bit of money for every purchase that you make, just a little bit of a percentage. So if you buy something really expensive, we get a lot more money. If you buy something, just, you know, like a pen or something, we're going to get like a couple of cents. But either way, it won't cost you anything extra, and we get a little bit of money, and it will help us do this show and help us do it a little bit better, because then we can, you know, pay for random things that we might need, like a disco ball in the studio.
It's really great because you can basically force Amazon into giving us money for yes. absolutely no reason.
Yes, it forces Amazon to give us money. So it's that simple. So go to the website, followthesoundpodcast.com, click on the Amazon banner, or go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. All right, folks, this week in music history, we've got September 18th through September 22nd. And we have a couple of really, really long ones, because I've read the notes going forward for the night. And to start things off on September 18th, Jacob Grum, what do you have?
All right, 1940, none other than Frankie Avalon is born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
The man.
Happy birthday.
He made his TV debut at age 12 playing trumpet on the Jackie Gleason Show.
Whoa. Frankie was a trumpet player?
Yep.
Did not know that.
Didn't it? Well, now you do. And it's not going to be the last you hear that trumpet either. His first film was also playing trumpet in the 1957 film Jamboree.
Oh, nice.
But this time he also added singing to the act, and he sang Teacher's Pet. In 1959, he had his best success as a recording artist, which, of course, you knew about
him. Yes, of course.
Yes. Of course, you knew about the two singles, Venus and Why.
Mm-hmm.
They both hit number one in the same year and were both certified gold.
Yes.
In 1960, seeing the success that the film Rio Bravo had had by casting the pop star Ricky Nelson, RCA Records decided that they wanted to pressure Frankie into doing a Western, and they did that, and he appeared in Guns of the Timberland. However, that plan backfired shortly. Because, like, Frankie decided that he was kind of tired of the recording biz. And he didn't record another pop album after appearing in Guns of the Timberland. Everything after that, he played trumpet on, and they were all jazz albums.
Nice.
Either as a band leader or as kind of like a weird solo project where
yeah.
he just kind of had studio artists come on in. However, his singing voice was not wasted, because he appeared in a whole bunch of just a slew of films all through the 50s. And after scoring leads for MGM in what was a war movie and then another drama, he was cast in what he's probably best remembered for, the film made by American International Pictures, Beach Party.
Beach Party.
And if you wanted to know, Beach Party kept AIP afloat for like a couple decades.
And yeah, because there was 1,000 sequels.
They made 11 sequels in total.
Oh, just yes. a shade under 1,000.
Yes. yeah. Frankie was in 11 of 12 of the films. The only film he wasn't in was Ghost in the Invisible Bikini, which starred Boris Karloff and was like a weird, like the Beach Party gang shows up to a haunted house.
Of course.
Yeah, the trailer looks amazing, and I so want to just get drunk and watch it.
Sounds like a plan. Let's
because
do it.
That's what I do. So there you go. Happy birthday, Frankie Avalon.
Yeah. I'm assuming he's still going, right?
Oh, yeah. He's still alive. He's still around.
Yeah.
You know, the one thing I will say is that kudos to him for starting to follow a field, a career that he was decent at, but he wasn't feeling it, and then he actually made that move. Because I always give props to people when they're bold enough to actually pursue their passions.
Yeah.
So it's cool that he saw success somewhere, and he said, that's great and all, but it's not what I want to do. And he pursued what he wanted to do, and he did fine from it.
You know, and it's so funny, because it shows you how terrible, like, being part of a cog in the machine of the music industry in the 50s was, where when you turned to Hollywood,
brutal.
You turned to Hollywood for artistic license.
For a little more freedom.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, you know, music, that was the monster for a long, long time. You know, everything was, even those early films that were based solely on good music, mm-hmm. you know, and all the old, like, Disney musicals and, just the classic old Hollywood. We actually saw La La Land the other day, which the whole movie is kind of makes it feel like an old Hollywood movie. So, music probably was a rough and tumble time back then.
Weird tangent for me. This last week I watched Take Me Out to the Ball Game, starring Frank Sinatra and Gene Kelly. Watched it for the first time. I was incredibly disappointed because Gene Kelly couldn't dance to his proper level because Sinatra had to dance with him, so they had to dumb down the dancing.
Yeah. That makes
and
sense.
All of the songs were kind of like forced into this whole baseball theme of a movie. It was like, all right, guys, here's the pitch. You're baseball players. You're also vaudeville performers. And it's going to have conflict. And that was it. That was the script.
Best baseball like, musical is Damn Yankees.
Though. Like, there's going to be some sexist jokes and some casual racism.
You know, talking about like the way they made films, there's a lot of like, and pun intended, really frank interviews with Frankie Avalon that were done like, I don't know, the last decade, where he talks about the motion picture industry at the time and being in all those beach party movies and how like he only hated it in retrospect. Like at the time he was just having fun. But, you know, afterwards he's like, you know, I kind of wish that maybe they had a better script because then people could have enjoyed it. But, you know, it was a summer comedy and kind of we were just doing it.
Right. You can always rip on it in hindsight.
Right. And there's a whole documentary on those beach party movies that is yet to be made. Because there's a guy by the name of Karloff who had this formula that he made for how to make a movie that people will go to. Not necessarily a hit, just a movie you can make money on all the time. And then that got turned into this formula for the entire AIP that all films were kind of subject to, with basic rules like a younger child will watch something an older child will watch, but an older child will never watch anything a younger child will watch.
Mm-hmm.
So they made movies just to appeal to like 19-year-old boys because that's what they figured that would cast the widest net.
Well, I can understand it though.
Yeah.
That's the one thing is whenever a 8-year-old kid is misbehaving and you just got to tell them that they're acting like a baby and then they stop because I'm not a baby. So anyways,
the formula for movies that definitely followed with Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland.
Oh yeah.
It's always something happened. We need to raise money. Let's put on a show. And then that's exactly what they do. So let's move on just a little bit. To a sad day in music history.
Here comes the first buzzkill.
1970, Jimi Hendrix was pronounced dead on arrival at St. Mary Abbott Hospital in London at the age of 27 after choking on his own vomit.
Mm.
Hendrix left the message, "I need help bad, man," on his manager's answer phone earlier that night. Rumors and conspiracy theories grew up around Hendrix's death. Eric Burdon claimed Jimmy had committed suicide, but that's contradicted by the reports that he was in a good frame of mind. In 2009, a former Animals roadie published a book claiming that Jimmy's manager had admitted to him that he arranged the murder of Hendrix since the guitarist wanted out of his contract.
Ooh, conspiracy.
It's very interesting. I don't think that's what happened. I think he honestly just died of drug overdose. But
well, if he said he needs help bad, man, and then he also choked on his own vomit... And, I mean, that's what the hospital said, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, it sounds like he just needed help bad, man.
Yeah. I think that's just what it was. I don't think he killed himself, though. I think it was just combination of drugs and stuff that just took him out. I mean, it happened to a bunch of other great ones, so.
I think every time a major artist dies, too, there's always going to be that conspiracy of who killed them.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I like Eric Burdon as much as anyone, but from all the stories I've heard, like, his tour bus was where drug addicts went to get overflow drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I don't think you can put any stock into anyone.
Yeah.
Like, the opinion of anyone who was near that bus.
Yeah. All right, Greg, you want to do the next one?
Yeah, well, this is a fun one. 1978, WKRP in Cincinnati debuts on CBS. Yay! The central plot of the show revolved around a radio station, which switches from easy listening to rock. It lasted 4 years, but was more popular in syndication, and I think people still talk about that show to this day.
As a proper radio guy, there were when I first got started and when I first interned at a local station here in St. Louis, KFUO, the older producers, the guys who had been there forever, they said, you got to watch WKRP in Cincinnati, and you've got to watch news radio. So these were the two shows. So I literally went, got every episode of WKRP in Cincinnati and binged watched the whole series, and it blew my mind how hilarious that show was. And also, it really is like that thing that radio people are wanting to achieve.
Yeah.
That sort of free reign to be creative and like play music that you want to play, and like you've always got that kind of sleazy salesperson who's in there. You always got like a weird news person. It's like,
oh yeah, radio stations.
Really, like the guy who wrote it, like obviously knew something about radio stations because he nailed some of that stuff.
Radio stations always foster some of the most unique personalities because you will get big, bold talent in here who are willing to talk to anybody and super friendly and yet kind of also backhandedly a dick. And then you'll have that one guy who is so socially awkward that you don't even understand how they got the job here in the first place, because you're like, how did you get through the interview? You know, and you work with those people and it's such a wide array. Gosh.
But for the life of me, I thought turkeys could fly.
For the life of me.
Go ahead, Jake. You've got this one.
Okay. 1983. Kiss appeared without their makeup for the first time during an interview on MTV promoting the new release, their newest release, Lick It Up. Aside from how disgusting the song is and the band without their makeup, Lick It Up, pretty forgettable.
Really?
Yeah,
That song isn't that forgettable. I mean, it's been on a thousand different.
I still don't know what they want to lick up, or do they want you to lick it up? I have no idea.
Yeah, I don't know.
I believe it's lick it up, ah ah ah. It's only right now. Lick it up, lick it up. Come on, come on.
Again, that.
Is this a Kiss song or Spinal Tap?
Right.
Yeah. Seriously, those lyrics sound like they were taken from like an open microphone that was just left in a hospital waiting room.
I don't know about that. Gross. I don't know about you guys, but I come from a very Kiss heavy background because I believe both of my parents are members of the Kiss Army.
Oh, jeez. Okay.
Both of them.
Probably conceived at a Kiss concert.
Quite possibly, or at least to a Kiss album. I remember one of my earliest childhood memories was when Kiss did MTV Unplugged in like the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And it was on TV and my parents were freaking out. And I was like, what is this? What's going on? And my mom just went into, this is Kiss. They're like one of the biggest bands in the world. And she took me over to the record player and started pulling out every one of their albums. She had every one of their albums. But when Kiss went without their makeup for the first time, you got to understand how crazy that was, because in a way they became the biggest band in the world because A, they had costumes and makeup, and B, they had crazy pyrotechnics. Their music is very generic rock and roll.
Yeah.
It's decent enough that I'll listen to it, but it was never like better than some of their...
I feel like the history of Kiss is Gene Simmons, a smart businessman, attaching himself to an easily controlled piece of talent in Ace Frehley.
Yeah.
And then just constantly in the studio going, do less.
Maybe. I remember Gene Simmons when he did an interview once, because, of course, Gene, I think most people know him, the demon with the long tongue and the blood and the fire breathing. Apparently, they were in a meeting and somebody said, somebody needs to breathe fire. And Gene was like, oh, I'm the demon. That'd be perfect. He didn't realize they meant literally, like, breathe fire on stage. He thought that would be his persona. And they said, okay, well, here's the guy who's going to teach you how to breathe fire. And they made him learn, and that became his thing. So, anyways, though, I don't know if they ever should have taken off their makeup. They're not very good looking guys. Mm-hmm. And
you could argue that it's the only way they could have kept relevant in, like in the U.S., like the music at
the
time.
They did need the PR stunt. And when they did it, I think there was a lot of long-haired rock bands that were more contemporary at the time.
Yeah.
So I get what you're saying about staying relevant where, you know, if they ditched the makeup, maybe it would look like they were entering the new decade with everyone else type thing.
I'd say at least they weren't like the hair metal bands, you know, completely. Like the other guys who basically looked like girls with the way that they had their makeup on. Mm-hmm. I mean, at least they were trying to do something a bit more like, I don't know, full on hardcore kind of stuff. So
because it's more like a David Bowie path where they become beyond life, you know, because they are. It's almost like they're fictional characters, and you can idolize that. Because I mean, with every band, when they have those alter egos and those personas, it does add to the appeal because it takes away the average Joe, and it allows you to see them as something bigger.
They're like wrestlers,
honestly. Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly right. Yeah, but what you're saying is that it wasn't like, you know, mascara and lipstick, or it wasn't, you know, the real glam rock. It was more just like bigger.
Yes.
And they ended up being the biggest band in the loudest band in the world.
I also, Greg, have a similar upbringing to yours in the fact that I still to this day have a photo of my father in high school as Gene Simmons. At a high school like talent show, and his face is painted. They went to the hardware store and bought a gallon of white bear paint and black bear, like what you would paint a house with.
No.
Yeah.
Wow.
Like there wasn't Johnny Brock's dungeon. You couldn't just go down and be like, hey, give me that black clown makeup and I'll do it. No.
Okay, so one last thing I will say, just to finally drive the point home that I was raised on Kiss. 16th year of my life, which was the last year I ever went trick-or-treating, I went as Paul Stanley for Halloween.
Nice.
Yep.
Oh, actually, this is to cap this off. This is the best Dan Camp possible. It was, so my dad told me the story about going and buying the paint at the hardware store and then having his girlfriend at the time paint everyone's face, right? And they actually did a pretty decent job. I heard that story like, I don't know, half a dozen times before, like somewhere in my 20s, I thought, you know, you never mentioned that you bought mineral spirits or any solvent to take that off of your face with. And he goes, yeah, the next day when we all tried to shower separately and the paint wouldn't come off, I went down to the hardware store.
Get some paint
with Gene Simmons paint still on my face to buy mineral spirits, and the guy at the hardware store was laughing so hard he could barely take my money.
I was gonna say, I should have just given it to him.
Yeah, I know, right? Like, you know what, kid, just take it.
You need this. I can't believe you're still breathing. Okay.
All right, I'll take the next one, though. Let's see here. 1998, Jet Williams takes the stage on the Grand Ole Opry for the 75th commemoration of her father, Hank Williams' birth. She plays Your Cheatin' Heart and takes note that Hank actually never sang the song live because it was released posthumously.
Wow. Interesting.
Such an iconic song for him, too.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's like probably one of the most notable ones for somebody like me who, you know, doesn't know a lot of Hank Williams. But I know Your Cheatin' Heart.
Yes.
Yeah. Also, happy birthday to Hank Williams. I guess that was the hidden fact in that message.
Yeah, yeah.
So, there you go. It's just, you know, I got a soft spot in my heart for some of the old country and definitely some of the Grand Ole Opry.
Also, if you want to know, so like almost every like 5 years, somebody plays at the Grand Ole Opry that has Williams as a last name. So like Hank Williams, Hank Williams Jr. and Hank Williams III have all played the Grand Ole Opry.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's kind of cool.
Well, I mean, they've had a ton of people play the Grand Ole Opry.
Well, yeah.
I mean, anybody who was popular back then, their child has probably done something at the Grand Ole Opry. I mean,
well, maybe.
Just it's just the way it is. Oh, man.
Oh, also, Jet Williams. Okay, sorry. Side note to that. So Jet Williams, like Hank Williams had like 4 families, right?
Something like that.
Jet Williams, her mother, whose last name is Jet, had signed papers to give her up to Hank when she had her, right? But Hank died before she was born. So she was adopted like 3 separate times, and it took her 20 years to find out who her father was.
No.
So like she was doing country music singing before she knew that her father was Hank Williams.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Wow. That's the perfect like destiny.
Yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
know? When you don't know who your father is, but you become a country artist, mm-hmm. and then you find out your father, your real biological father is Hank Williams.
Yeah.
I mean, that had to have been like an mind explosion mm-hmm. at that moment, too.
Oh, yeah. And because of the laws, because she was born in Mississippi, she had to get a lawyer, and it took her like 10 years to find out.
Wow. Well, hey, I'm glad she found what she was looking for.
Let's see here. Let's move on to September 19th. In 1934, born on this day, Brian Epstein, or Epstein, however you want to pronounce it, the Beatles manager and manager for other Liverpool acts, died of an accidental overdose of brandy and barbiturates on the 27th of August, 1967.
I don't think you can just overdose on brandy.
You got to have those barbiturates, too.
You got to have the right combination. Man, well, that sucks.
Yeah, well, is what it is.
Another one gone too
Brian's
soon.
One of those guys that, like, some of the stuff he did was kind of cool. Some of the stuff he did was super shady.
It's hard. It's hard to feel bad, but at the same time, you don't ever want to celebrate someone's death, per se.
Yeah. I mean, he definitely was a guy who was, like, he saw his meal ticket with the Beatles, and he took it. And he was able to control them for a good while. So.
And he bent them over for a few decades.
Yeah. Well, a decade, for a better part of a decade.
Well, more than 1 year, which is way too long to get screwed by your manager.
Yeah. Now, this next one, however, I put in here just because I felt like it.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, how often do you get to say that?
So, 1960, former chicken plucker Chubby Checker went to number 1 on the U.S. singles chart with The Twist. It made number 14 in the U.K. in 1962. The version with the Fat Boys made number 2 in the U.K. in 1988.
The Twist is an awesome song. It's a good one. Former chicken plucker.
Yes, former chicken plucker. Chubby Checker.
I love whenever we have those extra facts in there. Thank you for that.
So Chubby Checker, of course, he sang The Twist, and it was quite possibly the most influential dance ever,
because
it really kicked into the dance craze. Like everybody started writing songs that were, you know, dances, of which that doesn't really happen in pop music anymore. But it happens in rap music, which I find to be rather hilarious.
Oh, yeah. Every song's got a dance. We just got the St. Louis Bounce about a week ago.
Watch me whip. Watch me nay-nay.
That's right.
Watch me nay-nay.
The Cupid Shuffle.
Yeah, there's that. There's all those stupid wedding songs. It's eventually
Casper
what they become.
Casper Slide Part 16.
Yes.
Everybody clap your hands.
What's that one that's the whatever cha-cha?
Like cha-cha slide.
That's just cha-cha
slide. That's what I was just singing there.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Everybody clap your hands.
Oh, slide to the left.
Oh,
slide
God.
To the fourth dimension.
All right, folks. This next novel is brought to you by Jacob Crumb.
Thank you for that lovely intro. 1985. Frank Zappa, Dee Snider, and of course, John Denver speak in front of the PMRC, the Parents Music Resource Center, to oppose censorship. The committee, headed by Tipper Gore, had previously called for a rating system in an article published by the Washington Post, where they list a famous Filthy 15, a list of songs that they considered to be offensive. The article led to retailers Walmart, JCPenney, Sears, and Fred Meyer, now known as Kroger, to remove many rock magazines and several albums from their shelves. Early in the day, several members of the committee gave testimony in support of voluntary labeling by the music industry. Paula Hawkins, a founding PMRC member, in her testimony said, quote, "Much has changed since Elvis' seemingly innocent times. Subtleties, suggestions, and innuendo have given way to overt expression and descriptions of often violent sexual acts, drug taking, and flirtations with the occult," end quote. Susan Baker then testified, There certainly are many causes of these ills in our society, but it is our contention that the pervasive messages
aimed at children, which promote and glorify suicide, rape,
sadomasochism, and so on, have to be numbered among the contributing factors.
I got your back there, Jake.
Yes, and then a complete joke of the music industry, a professor from the University of Texas said of heavy metal music that it had, quote, "one of its central elements, the element of hatred." Now, in counterarguments, Frank Zappa asserted that the PMRC proposal is an ill-conceived piece of nonsense, which fails to deliver any real benefit to children, infringes on civil liberties of people who are not children, and promises to keep the courts busy for years dealing with the interpretation and enforcement problems inherent in the proposal's design. The next testimony came from John Denver, and this was actually kind of my highlight was John Denver's entire testimony. But just to sum him up, he said that he chided the PMRC and urged them to change their minds, saying that their proposal, and this is just a random quote, that which is denied becomes that which is most desired, and that which is hidden becomes that which is most interesting. Consequently, a great deal of energy is spent trying to keep and
No, I get what you're saying here, because every single one of these quotes is extremely wordy, and I feel like everybody involved in this suit was trying way too hard to use a large vocabulary.
Yes.
So I don't blame you, Jacob.
No. Actually, like, my tablet just now decided it wants to do, like, this flickering screen thing now, and it's, like, giving me Tourette's.
You want me to finish that?
You knock yourself right out, please.
So the quote from John Denver was, "that which is denied becomes that which is most desired, and that which is hidden becomes that which is most interesting. Consequently, a great deal of time and energy is spent trying to get at what is being kept from you." And I see why you like that quote, because that's brilliant.
Yeah, his entire testimony was great. And also, he had trouble saying that and had to repeat himself three times.
Denver was a smart man.
Yeah, so. He was. And it was kind of funny, because when he showed up, the entire committee thought that he was going to speak in favor of them. And the camera that is kind of over John Denver's shoulder is pointed right at Al Gore, and you can see the surprise on his face as John Denver starts, like, chiding them for censorship and how...
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, who expected John to be agreeing with, you know, Dee Snider
right.
and Frank Zappa?
Right.
Yeah.
However, most people remember Dee Snider because his clips were actually put on, like, every radio station, and people were surprised at how sort of eloquently and tactful he spoke.
Have you actually seen the video of this too?
Yes, I have.
He just walks out, like, you know, and he's dressed like he normally is and everything, pulls out a piece of paper and then just reads it. It's like, I loved it. It was actually really cool.
Right. So he came and he at one point compared a song of theirs, a Twisted Sister song called Under the Blade, and the way that it had been misrepresented by Tipper Gore. to a John Denver song, Rocky Mountain High, and how it was misrepresented in the media when it was launched and actually banned from several radio stations because they thought that the high part of Rocky Mountain High had nothing to do with camping.
Or the fact that it's like the mile, you know, Denver's the Mile High City.
Right. So they're like, no, that's obviously illicit drugs. That man is on psychedelics.
It couldn't possibly just being up in the mountains and being high up on the earth and like being overwhelmed by the majesty of these giant monoliths of rock. Couldn't possibly be that. It's got to be drug use.
Yes. So anyway, in reference to what Tipper Gordon said in the original PMRC article, Dee Snider said that the only sadomasochism, bondage, and rape in the song is in the mind of Mrs. Gore.
Bazinga!
He then stated that Mrs. Gore was looking for sadomasochism and bondage, and she found it. Someone lurking for surgical references would have found that as well. And then he concluded by saying, the full responsibility for defending my children falls on the shoulders of my wife and I, because there's no one else capable of making these judgments for us.
Boom!
Yeah.
Nailed it. Dee Snider said, oh, you thought you heard all these bad things in our song? That's probably because you wanted to hear those bad things in our song.
What's wrong with your mind?
Yeah, and then in their question, the committee's questioning, they pulled up a couple of like Twisted Sister's album covers and posters, and they were like, "Well, what do you have to say to that?" And he's like, "Well, that's like a rubber skeleton that's in a plywood coffin, and I would call that marketing."
Yeah,
you know, he was so arrogant. It was brilliant.
Yes,
it was brilliant.
But you know, I mean, that what John Denver said was so brilliant in the fact that it's like, okay, you know, if you are worried about the children shouldn't be listening to this music to begin with, and taking it away from everybody means that everyone who listens to and likes to and is old enough to be responsible, you're taking away rights for them, both the artists and the people who want to maybe consume the media. Like, I don't know. I already said what I meant, which is just that it was brilliant because especially the part where he's like, you are taking away people's rights with this without actually helping the children at all. And out of all three of those guys, John Denver is the one who had to put it out there.
Mm-hmm.
Brilliant.
You know, Frank Zappa, actually, his like 7 minutes were so well constructed, and he spoke so fast, you almost have to read it to actually catch everything, because he called out specific senators and saying that, you know, this bill was just in preparation for these several other bills that were also in committee and writers that were going to be attacked on several things. And what all ended up coming out of this was that the music industry did voluntarily put like parental labeling on albums anyway.
Yeah.
But kind of that was it, because having that much star power come up and speak kind of drew the public's attention, and like the three other bills that were in committee that Zappa, they all got thrown out.
I have to add,
they didn't even make it through committee. So
that last thing I said, that was actually the Frank Zappa quote, was the one that I was quoting.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because John Denver, he said that if you tell people they can't listen to it, they're going to want to listen to it more, which is also freaking brilliant.
It's exactly what happened with rock and roll in the 50s and 60s, you know? Mm-hmm.
Or in Russia, with American music
exactly.
In Russia.
And it's funny because now in our modern day, that's an actual intentional angle that you go through, is that like, in a lot of cases, I mean, I don't know, maybe books would be a good example, but you get a book added to like the banned book list, and suddenly you've heard of suddenly the book is getting publicity because it made the banned book list, and you're like, okay. You know, you might not have even realized it existed, but now you're telling me I can't read this?
Yeah.
So
let's go ahead and move on. Going up to 1992, Radiohead filmed the video for their new single, Creep, during a show at the venue in Oxford, England. During its initial release, Creep was actually not a chart success. However, upon re-release in 1993, it became a worldwide hit.
Interesting. Was the re-release re-recorded? Or was it just the same version?
I think it was just the same version. It's just that they released it as a single, and then they might have released it like on an album or something like that. I don't exactly know how it works.
Interesting.
But yeah, that's just what they did. They just got it out there again, and then it got picked up. And I mean, I remember seeing it in movies and stuff from the 90s. that just used it so very well, mainly because that part that really kicks it into high gear, you know, mm-hmm. and they're singing the chorus. It's like, because it fit with a lot of like that teen angst in the 90s, you know, it was like a lot of teenagers at that time didn't feel like they fit in with society. And so they felt, you know, like a creep, like a weirdo.
I think it's interesting, too, that you would re-release the song a year later, because like with the music industry, it's so fascinating how not only does it have to be a good song, but it also has to be the right time.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of bands out right now that we have, a handful of them are like brand new bands that are playing what's really popular. And so you kind of think to yourself, maybe this band was formed around trying to have a hit for what's popular right now.
Chainsmokers.
Yeah, they just go with the flow. You know, they pop up out of nowhere. You never heard of them, but they're like the biggest band. And then you have bands like, a good example would be, I think, Spoon, who they've been around for quite a while. And their success was moderate, if anything. And now that that's what's really popular, you have guys in their mid-20s who are putting out bands, but then you also have bands that have been around for 30 years mm-hmm. that are getting popular now because their time has finally come, because they were way ahead of their time. And I think about all those bands that called it quits because they were putting out stuff in the 90s that now kids in the 20-teens yeah. are just eating it up,
yeah.
you know, 30 years later. So it's just interesting. That might have had something to do with Creep being re-released a year later and being a sudden hit, even though it was already out for a whole year.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
like, in that old stalwart of a band that finally their time shows up, The Offspring is one of those bands that come to mind. Mm-hmm. Because they were playing, like, a lot of the same music in the 80s, like the early 80s.
Yeah.
And what was it? What was their big song?
Early on?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, super early on, they had done that Jenny, what is it? It's like Jenny's Got It. No. I was going to say Jenny's Got a Gun, like Aerosmith, Jamie's Got a Gun, but no. It was like a Jenny Goes to the something. Where's Google when you need it?
I know, I'm working on it.
Anyways, yeah.
Yeah, but you get it. I mean, they had a song they recorded, like, in the mid-80s that came out, what, in, like, 94?
Yeah, like it finally gets put on the actual album.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We covered that in the show months ago. But
You're talking about self-esteem or something?
Maybe. No, it wasn't self-esteem. It was whichever. It doesn't matter.
Anyways,
it really doesn't
matter. The Violent Femmes' Twister in the Sun was released in the early 80s and didn't become popular until the 90s. Which also makes them ineligible for Grammys.
Blister in the Sun. I was
Blister
like,
in the Sun.
Blister
Sorry,
in the Sun.
That's what I meant. Sorry. Got my word mixed up. Blister and Twister.
Well, we got Twisted Sister.
Twisted Sister.
And we got Blister in the Sun,
yeah.
And we've got The Offspring and The Kiss.
Many things.
Well, anyways, let's keep moving. So 1997, popular VH1 show Storytellers airs a special live episode featuring Elton John at the House of Blues in New Orleans. The live event went well and put the show into double time, with VH1 ordering two times the episodes for the following year. To date, they have aired 98 episodes, the last of which in 2015 featuring Ed Sheeran. The first episode featured Ray Davies, and draws its name from Ray's Storyteller Hour.
Tour.
Oh, I'm sorry, tour. Oh, man, I did so good until the very last word. Tour, yes. So VH1 Storytellers, that's an awesome show. If you want to see some really good, like, behind the scenes, like,
yeah.
you know, VH1, man, honestly, there's a whole series of those shows, like, behind the music and stuff. Mm-hmm. I miss a lot of that, because it was really
VH1
good.
And... because MTV stopped doing the whole music thing, right. But VH1 ended up going on and like doing a ton of music stuff. And then, of course, the other channel, Palladia, which is just like straight music.
That's a good channel, yeah.
So it's one thing I missed from having cable was watching Palladia, because I used to wake up and I'd just put it on like first thing in the morning, and then I'd watch it until I had to go. Then I'd get home and I'd start watching it again.
Well, it makes you wonder if Elton John kind of paved the road for a lot of those shows we know and love, because, Like we said, in 97, Storytellers, they put on a live episode with Elton John at the House of Blues, and now it was so huge that they had to completely overhaul their show because the demand went up. Everybody loved that one episode so much that they started putting out twice as many episodes.
Well, when you're a cable station and you can get people to actually watch you at like 11 p.m., you're just like, I'm going with this.
Yeah, and live.
Yeah.
Live TV, too.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, let's move on. Of course, we are still on September 19th, 2010. John Lennon's son, Julian, told the press that he had ended his long-running feud with his half-brother, Sean, and his stepmother, Yoko Ono, which, of course, started after the former Beatle was murdered in December of 1980. The trio battled in court for a share of the singer's estate, but Julian now said, things are good between us. Whenever I'm in New York, we all get together.
And it only took 30 years.
Yeah.
30
and actually,
years.
I saw what kind of happened. Sean was doing a show in New York, and Julian showed up and like met him backstage and stuff, and kind of like they had a heart to heart, you know, where Julian was basically like, "Look, you know, you are my brother. Like, let's forget about all this stuff in the past. Let's, you know, let's just move forward and be the sons that are the brothers that we know our dad would have wanted us to be.
And what everybody else probably wanted."
I'm not quoting Julian, of course. I'm just saying that's roughly what the conversation was. And so, you know, yeah, they finally patched things up and he patched things up with Yoko as well. So that was nice. That's a good thing. That's a mitzvah.
Good. So when in New York, we all get together.
This next one requires a radio voice.
Oh, really?
Okay, from someone. Fine. I don't care who.
I'll do it. I got it.
Okay.
In 2012, Sierra Blanca, a town in West Texas with a population of 553 people, embarrasses the human race itself when they arrest Fiona Apple after a random search of her tour bus at a checkpoint, in air quotes. Miss Apple spends the night in a cell and posts bail the following day. Other tour buses stopped in Sierra Blanca include Nelly, Snoop Dogg, and Willie Nelson. The most incredulous thing about Sierra Blanca is not that they don't have enough people to support a grocery store, but that they have a permanent U.S. Border Patrol checkpoint 30 miles from the Mexican border.
So, if you're coming from Mexico, they essentially just stop you in their town.
Yeah, pretty much.
Which is not their job to do. But
there
it also, it clearly seems like they have a type that they're looking for.
Now, some of the situation has changed with, had changed, in 2014 with the previous administration. I have no idea what's going on in Sierra Blanca now. But I did read an article that prompted some changes. The article was written in December, like 2013, that stated that Sierra Blanca inspects more vehicles per day than they have residents.
Well,
so something near of like 600 vehicles, they were just randomly, meh, hey, what's in here?
Yeah. I mean, that does make sense, though. I'm sure they get plenty of through traffic.
Well,
but it's just funny because I do actually recall just hearing this story when it happened, because they were talking about how the same people who stopped Snoop Dogg stopped Willie Nelson.
Yes.
And I remember hearing that story when it happened, because there was like viral videos and jokes left and right coming from it all too, because it was like, oh, Snoop Dogg, Willie Nelson all got stopped in the same small town in Texas. Like, how did they know? What were they looking for? Gee, I wonder.
Was it just a tour bus, perhaps?
Yes. Yeah, they're like looking at Snoop Dogg's tour dates like, he's going to be coming through here. I just know it.
All right, so let me give you a little bit of stuff here on Sierra Blanca. One,
oh, okay. Let's
hear
it.
When it said that it's in West Texas.
Can I add, is this one of those towns that their mayor is a dog?
No.
Okay, go on.
when they say it's West Texas.
They mean
West Texas.
Yeah.
This is the county just to the right of the last county in Texas to the west.
Is that El Paso?
It's actually in, I think that's something like that as far as its actual county that it's
just
in.
East of the old West Texas.
It's the county of Hudspeth. Yeah, I'm not joking. That's what it is.
Okay.
Let's see here. The total population as of the 2010 census is 553. And it actually, but here's the funny thing. It actually has a density of 116 people per square mile. Do you know how big the city is?
Four square miles.
Oh, huh.
4.1 to be exact.
Oh, excuse me. I spoke out of turn.
11 kilometers for those of you who are living outside the U.S. Yeah, it's just, this is a tiny, tiny little town, and it just happens to have a road that goes through it.
Wow.
That's basically it. 83% white, then some Native American, Black, and Asian people, too.
Oh, you mean Sierra Blanca lives up to its name?
Yeah.
Wow.
Actually, they're named after the mountains that are nearby, the Sierra Blanca Mountains.
Oh, it's not Blanco.
But yes, they are known very well for their checkpoint and stopping people and arresting them for possession of marijuana.
TMZ likes to refer to it as the checkpoint of the stars.
Nice.
So, you know, whenever marijuana is finally legalized by the federal government, Sierra Blanca is just going to go out of business.
Yeah. Or it'll become a destination point.
That's true. It could become a destination point.
Wouldn't that be ironic if marijuana was legalized and Sierra Blanca became like one of the main, like, hey, we're going to Sierra Blanca where they got the good stuff? Because that would probably really piss off everybody who's there for years.
Oh, yeah. Willie Nelson opens a dispensary there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have the Willie Nelson and they have the Snoop Dogg shops on either end of town.
Man, just put them right across the street from each other.
Oh, man.
Because, yeah, like, who wouldn't want to go smoke a J right where Willie Nelson got arrested?
I know. And put up a plaque that says, like, on this date, here, we arrested Willie Nelson for the same thing you're doing now legally.
Mr. Nelson suffered for our freedoms. Yeah.
So let's see. The U.S. Border Patrol checkpoint at Sierra Blanca sends the county thousands of drug cases a year and inspects between 15 and 20,000 vehicles every day. That's a big gap, 15 to 20,000. But the county is unable to prosecute the vast majority of these cases as the federal government no longer funds such activities. Huh. They don't even care about prosecuting minor drug possession charges. Yeah.
It's funny because this town probably is the same town that the one guy sits in his lawn chair with a radar gun and like reports speeders to, you know. I just saw a white sedan going 50 in a 30 and I'm going to call it in. I just saw another tour bus go by just giving you the heads up.
Right. You know what? That's enough of this story.
Yep. Bye.
We're done with Sierra Blanca.
And with September 19th.
Yes. Let's move on to September 21st. We have born on this day, Leonard Cohen.
We don't have the 20th?
Oh, did I skip one?
Or is this the 20th?
Yes, we have the 20th.
Okay. I skipped the 20th. Time out. Yes, let's move on to September 20th, 1969, during a meeting in London between John Lennon, Paul McCartney, and Ringo, Lennon announced he was leaving the Beatles.
No! Say it ain't so.
So yeah, that's it. That's all I got. That's the only story for that one.
Oh, that was the only story for this day?
No, I'm just saying that's all I got for that story. I've got nothing to add to it.
I love how nobody cared enough about what George thought to invite him to the meeting. He's like, all right, yeah, 3 out of 4 ain't bad. Listen, I'm done.
Well, hey, on that very same day, we had another interesting story based on the comic book TV series Archie and His Friends. The Archies started a 4-week run at number 1 on the U.S. singles chart with Sugar Sugar. Honey, honey. You are my candy girl. And you got me wanting you. It became the longest running one-hit wonder in the U.K. after spending 8 weeks at the top of the charts.
Yeah,
and
I thought that was funny.
It is a good song, though. It's catchy.
It is very catchy.
Yeah. I think a lot of people forget who does that song too. So a nice little one-hit wonder for you.
Yeah, I couldn't have told you before if you'd asked me.
The Archies. See, there was a point in time where I made it a goal to like try and know a lot of one-hit wonders, so I could like be that guy. But I'll tell you what, it's not worth it. Anyways, the very next year,
1970.
Good,
yeah.
Jake.
Okay,
what you
so
got?
Right up front, all the articles that I read had 4 or 5 different days listed for this.
Okay.
So I'm just going to say the 20th because that seems to be when this event actually happened.
Wait, does this call for the Jim Morrison dick alert?
Yes, it does.
Yay!
Give it to us.
It's been a while, but we finally have to talk about Jim Morrison's dick.
Yet again.
His dong.
Go yes. for it.
His wang.
So,
Morrison penis alert.
So I believe that on September 20th, 1970, Jim Morrison's trial concludes as a Miami judge finds him guilty of indecent exposure and sentences him to 6 months in prison and a fine of $500. Mm. Morrison filed an appeal. Might have been a couple days later, might have been the same day. I'm not sure. Which kept his sentence stayed. However, his death in July of 71 in Paris successfully kept him out of prison. Yet the story did not end there, because in 2007, the governor of Florida, Charlie Crist, gave Morrison a posthumous pardon, which proves that you can't keep a good penis down.
Yeah.
Charlie Brown.
You can't keep a good one down. The rest of them can go home. Well, I can't get enough of that Jim Morris dong.
All right, Jake, you're going to have to do the next one, too.
All right. So 2 weeks ago, we talked about Graham Parsons from the Byrds.
Yes.
Right? Today, we're going to talk about another Parsons from the Byrds, 1973. Oh, we talked about Gene Parsons.
Yeah, Gene Parsons.
Gene Parsons. This week, we're talking about Graham Parsons.
Yeah.
Okay, so 1973, Graham Parsons, not to be confused with Gene Parsons of the Byrds, but also of the Byrds and the Flying Burrito Brothers. Graham Parsons' body was stolen from LAX International Airport. Now, Graham Parsons was born Ingram Cecil Conner III in Winter Haven, Florida in 1945. And he had a very sprawling career that went through country music and the Byrds and the Flying Burrito Brothers and ended very much too soon when he overdosed on morphine at the age of 26 on September 19th, the previous day. He took the name Parsons after his stepfather, Bob Parsons, not to be confused with the GoDaddy billionaire, Bob Parsons. But Bob took custody of Graham's body after the autopsy, which was done the same day as his death on the 19th, and arranged for his body to be transferred back to Louisiana with intentions of having him buried there. Now, Graham's girlfriend, Margaret Fisher, had other ideas. She was insistent that Graham's wishes was that he be cremated and his ashes scattered in Joshua Tree National Park. She also believed that Bob only wanted to bury Graham in Louisiana so that he could use Graham's final resting place as proof that he had a residency in Louisiana, hence making Bob the inheritor of Graham's estate. So she enlisted the help of fellow bandmate Phil Kaufman and one of their roadies to steal Graham's body, and they did. They drug the body and the coffin all the way out to Joshua Tree National Park, poured 5 gallons of gasoline on it, and tossed in a match. The fireball that followed alerted the National Park Rangers, and 2 days later, they turned themselves in. They got away, but didn't get away with it. They pleaded guilty and were fined $750 for stealing a coffin because in California, it's not a crime to steal a body.
Apparently, they don't have that problem.
Oh, that is great.
Gosh, that is a long and really weird tale.
Yes.
And the worst part is that 9 times out of 10 when it involves stealing bodies?
Yes.
Yeah, there's a large amount of money involved.
Mm-hmm. Now, okay, I'm going to say in defense of the baggage handlers at LAX, you really don't have to look after a body that well. You pretty much expect it to stay where you set it.
Right.
Right?
It's just like a dog with no legs.
More or less. Take it out for a drag every morning.
Where do you find a dog with no legs? Right where you left them.
There you go.
Sad. So is that it? We can move on?
We can move on from
okay,
that.
Okay, fine. How about 1975 Fame gave David Bowie his first number one hit in the U.S. The song was co-written by John Lennon, and Lennon's voice is heard towards the end of the song, repeating the words, fame, 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 from a fast track through a regular track to a slow track before Bowie finishes the lyrics.
John Lennon on Fame, huh?
Yeah.
Did not know that.
He co-wrote it. I didn't know that either. That's why I put it in there.
Yeah.
I thought that was a little fascinating fact. But, you know.
Now, I had heard before that he had something to do with the writing of it. I didn't know they laid vocals for it.
Yeah, I didn't know it.
That's news.
Yeah. So there you go.
All right.
Something, small little fact for the day.
1992.
Yes.
Hey, let's do this.
Go for it.
Pearl Jam plays a free concert in Magnuson Park in Seattle, Washington, where they promote Rock the Vote.
I remember that.
Yes, and several thousand fans registered to vote in the upcoming 1992 U.S. presidential election. Just food for thought, by comparison to today's administration, how just good would it have to be like a neocon? Like, by comparison, how good does that look? Just a crusty old neocon. Doesn't that just feel retro and fun?
No.
No.
You see, here's the funny thing. I remember the Rock the Vote stuff.
Yeah.
And they're still doing it to this day.
Mm-hmm.
But the only reason why I've never really cared for the Rock the Vote thing is because they do it with a nod and a wink.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they do it with the, you know, it's not just, hey, you know, we're going to register, you know, we want you to get registered so you can vote. Now, that's what the commercials say. But anytime they do anything live, it's like, we want you to, like, to get registered to vote so you can vote Democrat.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know what? It's like, get people to vote because, you know, it's their duty to vote. It's like, don't get them to vote just because you're a celebrity and you can, you know, like, steer them in a political direction.
I mean, I don't know. I don't really have an opinion on people's motives when it comes to Rock the Vote.
Yeah, I'm just saying.
Yeah.
It was always one of those things that kind of bugged me, especially in this last time around, because they were really hardcore, like, trying to get out the vote for Bernie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So that was my only, like, it's like, I'm all for things that are neutral, like, when it comes to the political spectrum.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, but the second you start picking sides to things, like, especially if you're a celebrity, an artist, or whatever it happens to be, that's where I'm like, all right, you should have drawn a line here. And you crossed it.
I mean, okay. All right. I will say that as long as you're towing the same line that, like, nonprofits are expected to tow, like,
yeah, that's kind of,
is that's what you're going for?
Yeah, I could kind of go in that direction. So.
Either way, I know every time that they do one of those Rock the Vote things, that, like, several thousand people register to vote in, like, a county that they don't live in.
Yeah. You know what I love, though, is the fact that where the Rock the Vote actually came from in the first place.
Okay.
So here's the story.
Yes.
In the late 60s, early 70s, the hippie movement was in full swing, right? And so they did a massive campaign to get people to not vote.
Yeah, okay, yeah, yeah.
So a massive group of college-age, you know, students and, you know, younger adults and stuff, basically they told them, do not participate in the election. And then Nixon won again. And then after Nixon won again, that's when they realized, oh, our mistake is that we didn't get people to vote who could have then voted for the guy that they wanted, the anti-war guy.
Right. So their plan was the plot from Brewster's Millions?
Their original problem was that they got people to not vote, and then they spent the rest of their time just trying to get people to vote. So that's where Rock the Vote was born from.
Vote none of the above.
Vote none of the above. It's kind of what I did this last election season, so... but yeah, that's all we got for September 20th. We're going to go ahead and move on to September 21st. 1934, born on this day, Leonard Cohen, the Canadian singer, songwriter, musician, painter, poet, and novelist. Cohen is a companion of the Order of Canada, which is actually a very big deal in Canada, the nation's highest civilian honor. Of course, he wrote the extremely famous song Hallelujah, and it was which was first released on Cohen's studio album Various Positions in 1984, and I mean, it's been covered by everyone.
Yeah, I was going to say it may have been covered as many times as yesterday.
That's possible.
As much as yesterday.
Especially now.
Yeah.
Cuz it just keeps gaining in popularity. The only thing is that like it's kind of been covered to death for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I like certain people who have done it, but
yeah.
At the same time it's like
surprisingly, and yes, you know,
I've heard
why
a Christian version of it too. So
I think my favorite not Leonard Cohen version is actually Rob Thomas.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Interesting.
I heard him do it on some special, and I was like, hey, that guy can actually sing that song.
Yeah. I've seen him live several times. He actually is very good at that.
Yeah.
Let's see here. You can go ahead and take this next one.
All right. 1967, rather.
Yes.
Faith Hill was born Audrey Faith Perry in Ridgeland, Mississippi. Brian.
Yes.
How much do you love Faith Hill?
I mean, I like her quite a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying like I'm a super fan or anything, but.
How can you not be a super fan of Faith Hill? I mean.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm just not a super fan of Faith Hill.
Oh, but, all right then.
Yeah. But there you go. Ridgeland, Mississippi.
Are we getting?
Congrats.
Are we getting like an awkward rift in the show right now?
Yeah,
between the Faith Hill lovers and the Faith Hill deniers.
Yeah, you know what? Like this 27 years of friendship is just too much at this point.
27? That's how long you think we've been together? 27 years.
29.
We met when we were 5. It's been 29 going on 30 years.
You guys go way back.
Going back.
All right. Let's see. 1972, September 21st. We, of course, have another birthday. Born on this day, Liam Gallagher, vocalist for Oasis. Of course, the first single that they had in 1994 was Supersonic. And, I mean, they just went on to have a ton of success and then weirdly imploded. And now the brothers hate each other.
I mean, I would suspect that they kind of always hated each other.
So, well, yeah, but I mean, they're brothers. It's, I mean, a certain level of hatred is expected.
Like required.
Required, you know.
Almost.
Oh my gosh, that launched so many issues with that band.
Yes, yes.
Which we covered in previous episodes, so you can always go back and
I made a cognitive decision at one point to just stop covering Liam Gallagher punching fans because it's almost every like 3 weeks.
Just like get it,
yeah.
You do a lot of kung fu fighting.
So happy birthday to Leonard Cohen, Faith Hill, and Liam Gallagher.
But.
Greg. Please do this next one.
In 1974, Carl Douglas was number one in the UK on the singles chart with his hit song, fellas.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was kung fu fighting. Those kicks were fast as lightning. The song was recorded, had started out as a B-side and went on to sell over 10 million copies, made Douglas officially a one-hit wonder.
Yep. There you go.
If you gave me, like, 20 minutes and a five-hour energy and my best brain power recollection that I've ever had of remembering obscure details, Carl Douglas would never come to mind.
I thought you were going to say if I gave you 20 minutes and an energy drink, you'd be kung fu fighting.
No. I mean, I would go through like every name in my brain. I mean.
No, well, there you know.
Even Frederick Douglass. I would probably name Frederick Douglass before Carl Douglas.
Well, there you go. Carl Douglas, kung fu fighting. He was the man. And now
and we're richer for it.
Yeah. Well, and of course, with this show, from one cool, fun thing like Kung Fu fighting to another sad moment in history.
September 21st, 1980, during a North American tour, Bob Marley collapsed while jogging in New York's Central Park. After hospital tests, he was diagnosed as having cancer. Marley played his last ever concert two nights later at the Stanley Theater in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Yeah. So, not necessarily Bob Marley passing away, but certainly on that path.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate.
Yeah. But,
and can I also just say that with the medical technology of the time of the 80s, and considering the advanced enough stage of Marley's cancer at the time, treatment, he would still not be, he would not be around today if he had actually sought treatment.
Yeah.
But please, please, for everyone's best interest, if nothing else, just for the advancement in medical technology, please get treated and not just allow your cancer to progress because of your religious beliefs. Like, please set that aside.
Yeah, a little PSA out there is get it checked.
Yeah.
And now, and I get what you're saying, too, because now it's 2017.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
oh, yeah.
This happened in 1980, but it's 2017 now. So this is one of those moments where you can at least take it as a learning lesson and just think the opportunities that are given to us now that weren't available for somebody, even like somebody like Bob Marley, who wasn't able to get those things. So life, you know, no matter what they say, I know it's a tangent, but, you know, no matter what they say, this is the best time to be alive ever in human history. And so, you know, we just have to take learning lessons like this and move forward. But we do miss Bob Marley. He talk about an inspiration to a lot of people.
And another thing being that one of the reasons why he didn't actually seek treatment for it was because they would have had to amputate his toe. And according to the Rastafarian religion, you have to keep your body whole.
Yeah, again, really dumb. Now, I've actually read articles on this written by medical professionals, and they all have, like one guy's like, oh, they would cut the toe off, and he would have had treatment, he'd still be here. And then the next person's like, oh, no, I mean, he was in a bad way, you know, maybe at the time they might have extended his life by 38 months, you know. But it, regardless, he completely declined treatment because he's a fucking idiot. I hate to say that about Bob Marley, but a time not to be a fucking idiot is when a doctor just tells you what your treatment is.
Well, now, Jacob, I see where you're coming from, but it's easier said than done. There's a saying, you can lead a horse to water,
but you can't make a Rastafarian take treatment, apparently.
That's right. Well, we got another nice essay here for you. That's okay. I like the stories that have a really cool backstory. So 1987.
Yes. So this is a massively strange and epic journey. 1987, the influential bassist Jaco Pastorius dies at age 35 of brain hemorrhaging 10 days after falling into a coma stemming from a fight with a bouncer. After having released three solo jazz albums that sold poorly and a tour with Burrell LaGrange that drew very little attention, Jaco was living in Florida and homeless. He had already lost or sold all of his equipment and was doing odd studio gigs just to get by. Strangely enough, the cocaine culture that was sort of fueling his addiction was also keeping him in work in Florida. That's the only reason there was a music industry there in the 80s. However, on the night of September 11th, 1987, Jaco snuck into a Carlos Santana concert and took part in his new hobby. Being homeless and not having any real steady gigs, Jaco was getting his jollies by provoking bar fights. After scamming his way into the show, Jaco went on stage to disrupt the concert and got in a fight with a bouncer and was ejected from the venue. He then walked over to the Midnight Bottle Club and was denied entry for being just too drunk. He kicked in the glass door of the bottle club, the front door of the bottle club, and a bouncer by the name of...
Is it Luke Haven?
Yes, by the name of Luke Haven, gave him his very last beating, what turned out to be. Jocko was taken off of life support and pronounced dead at Boward General Medical Center in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Later, Luke Haven pled guilty to manslaughter. But Jocko's revolutionary work with Weather Report and all of his solo jazz is still with us. His playing style was instrumental in developing electric bass technique. So one high note on Jocko's career is that he's the only electric bassist in the Downbeat Jazz Hall of Fame. Now, Downbeat magazine is a very important jazz magazine, and every year they have a reader poll where they elect people into a Hall of Fame, and Jocko is one of six bassists and the only electric bassist that's been inducted. But to close out on a sweet note, Jocko's bass, the Bass of Doom, was a 1962 Gender Fast Bass, Fender Jazz Bass, that Jocko had taken a butter knife to and removed the frets. He had it with him throughout his career until, while he was homeless, still in Manhattan Island, it was stolen from him while he was sleeping on a park bench. In 2006, the bass was found by a collector in a pawn shop, and it was auctioned off. Jocko's family, hearing about the auction, but not having enough money to actually win the auction, put all their money that they could into a lawyer to try and reclaim the bass. They failed to do so and more or less went broke, the entire family. And there was an article written about it in 2010. And then comes heavy metal god Robert Trujillo, bassist for countless metal bands. If you want to be a famous metal band, get Robert Trujillo to play bass for you. But he actually pennied up the money himself and bought the bass from the gentleman who won the auction and returned it to Jocko's family in 2010.
So a bit of a happy ending, but yeah. I mean, you can understand the family after all that, too. They're like, can we at least just have like the one memory left of the guy? I mean, geez. So, but kudos to Robert for going out and just doing it, you know, just to be nice, just to do the right thing. Really?
So. Yeah, I mean, if it wasn't like a toy soldier that was left at his parents' house, it's that bass is the only possession that his family has of him.
Yeah.
You know.
Wow. Boy, that's somebody who, you know, kind of faded into history, because I didn't know any of that.
Yeah, about his death or just, like, his music at all?
Well, just the fact that, I mean, he just struggled and struggled and struggled more, then became homeless, and someone stole his only possession, and then he died. Like, ugh. I mean, he kind of brought it on himself, though, because it sounds like he kind of turned into a dick at one point.
Yeah, I mean,
but, you know,
there's not a whole lot of arguing.
This struggle probably had a lot to do with that. Mm-hmm. So
most people who sneak on the stage at a Carlos Santana concert are doing it to have fun.
Not to start a fight.
Right.
Yeah. Well, something more interesting.
I would like to point out, though, that had that happened in today's society, it's like it probably would have been caught on camera. And there's always the possibility that, like, somebody gets up on stage and then, you know, suppose he was like, you know, hey, I can play the bass. I want to play bass. And then he starts busting out some, like, awesome chops.
That would have
been like, weird homeless guy plays amazing bass.
Yeah. The homeless man with the golden fingers.
With the golden fingers.
Yep.
That's how it would play out now.
Well, not only that, too, but as soon as the bass was stolen, all over Facebook, you'd see people sharing, being like, keep an eye out for this bass. It was stolen last night while I was sleeping.
Yeah. Let's set up a GoFundMe page.
Yeah. For the auction.
Yeah.
Well, this next one, it's pretty simple.
Go for it.
I can do it because none other than the great grunge gods of the 90s, the year was 1993, and Nirvana released the single All Apologies along with Rape Me as the B-side. Both songs, of course, ended up being huge singles, with Rape Me, of course, getting a lot more publicity because, well, because of the whole...
That song's called Rape Me?
Yeah, that was kind of the big obvious point. But I remember, too, when MTV asked Nirvana very kindly but very sternly to change the lyrics from Rape Me to Waif Me during a live performance. So that was the thing. That's where Waif Me came from. And, of course,
guess what the band did? They got on stage. They said, nope, waif me. No problem. Got it. Got it. Sounds good. Got on stage and played the song exactly as it's written. No surprise there. So, nice job, Nirvana, and a couple of good tracks from them there. And I think that closes out our day.
For September 21st. So let's go ahead and move on to September 22nd, 1958. Joan Jett is born. Joan Marie Larkin in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. In 2010, of course, there was the Runaways movie. And that actually, I saw that one. It was surprisingly good.
Yeah.
The thing that I thought was kind of funny, and I've heard jokes in reference to the Runaways that basically they called them jailbait because all the girls were like super young.
Yeah.
But they were like portraying them as more like of a grown up act because it was all the punk music and stuff. It was very interesting to see because they fully like there were some dudes who would totally be in prison today. Had like some of their antics ever like actually been known?
Yeah.
I mean, like they were known for basically seducing older men.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, because
on some level,
the Runaways we're talking like 13, 14, and 15 years old.
Yes,
they were way too big of a band for their age.
Really. Oh, so, yeah. I mean, they opened for like everybody.
Yeah, if
like
you're wondering, too, the Runaways, their big hit was Cherry Bomb.
Yeah.
Yes. So I've seen Joan Jett twice now. Joan Jett opened for Heart this like last year, and I saw them when Joan Jett actually played at Warped Tour, which was actually kind of awesome because it was like this thing of, you know, hey, here's all of these other like, you know, newer bands and stuff like Motion City Soundtrack played and stuff like that. But here's kind of the funny thing is that Motion City Soundtrack, like the lead singer from them, actually ran from his gig to go see Joan Jett play. That's how iconic she was, is that all the rest of the artists who were there were just like, holy crap, we got to see her show. And so they all like flocked around there. But it was, and they put her on like one of the small stages on the side, but it was just packed. Everybody up the hill, everybody down on the, like, it was one of the most incredible shows that I actually saw there. But Joan Jett still going strong, still rocking out for all of these years now.
Happy birthday, Joan Jett.
Now, I got to do this next one. Because this is you know the one that I loved for this week, and that is 1969. The band releases their self-titled album, which of course peaked at number 9 on the U.S. charts, but included the hits "Rag Mama Rag," "Up on Cripple Creek," and "The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down." In 2009, the album was preserved into the National Recording Registry because the album was culturally, historically, and aesthetically important and reflects life in the United States. Not bad for a group of Canadians and one American.
You represent America well. Well, thank you. We'd love to be members of it someday.
Just cracks me up. They had one Southerner and the rest of them were Canadians, and yet they produced some of the best American music out
there. Hey, like four of those guys were like from Alberta, right?
Yeah.
So practically American.
I mean like, most of Canada is practically America.
Right, but I mean Alberta more so. I mean,
it's not like they're from Quebec.
Exactly. That's what, like Alberta, they wear cowboy boots and
that's
they look like Texans.
You know,
they're the Texas of the North.
You don't lie because like Alberta and like Saskatchewan, like they both are very like country Americana type provinces in Canada. But then the more metropolitan side, I will say, that was Ontario, because like Toronto.
Ontario!
Like Toronto might as well.
I mean, just recently, you know, I was in Toronto and it was a fascinating city. I loved it. Absolutely loved it. I want to go back again just so I can explore some more stuff. So we did most of the touristy things while we were there.
We'll save the rest of that for the Canadian podcast.
But either way, the band, their self-titled album, one of my all-time favorite albums. And I still listen to it at least several times a year because I love it. Of course, all of their hits on there are not my favorite song on the album. My favorite song is Jawbone. So,
Jawbone.
And if you go back, you can actually listen because I did an album review of this album a good while back, and it still blows me away. Like listening to it and doing the review still just floored me how good that album was. And I listen to it all the time. It's like, but
FollowTheSoundPodcast.com.
Yes, mm-hmm. I'll put a link somewhere in this post.
All right.
About this.
So how badly do we actually want to talk about Farm Aid?
I want to talk about it very badly.
We have to acknowledge it.
Because we have to acknowledge its existence since I put this note in here.
Okay, go for it then.
Fine. I'm talking a lot this episode for some reason. And then you're talking a lot too, Jake. So let's see. 1985, the first Farm Aid benefit concert was held before a crowd of 80,000 people at the Memorial Stadium in Champaign, Illinois. The great and wonderful Champaign. Woo!
Yay!
Organized by Willie Nelson, John Mellencamp, and Neil Young, the event had been spurred on by Bob Dylan's comments at the Live Aid earlier that year that he hoped some of the money would help American farmers. The star-studded lineup of country stars included Alabama, Hoyt Axton, Glenn Campbell, Johnny Cash, Charlie Daniels Band, John Denver, Bob Dylan, John Fogerty, Vince Gill, Merle Haggard, Emmylou Harris, Waylon Jennings, George Jones, Kris Kristofferson, Loretta Lynn, Roger Miller, Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, Willie Nelson, Charlie Pride, Bonnie Raitt, and Kenny Rogers. That is an all-star lineup.
That's a great lineup. And coming to a town like Champaign, Illinois.
Champaign!
They've got the U of I, but it's just that was a big thing. So coming from Central Illinois... Yeah, we hear about Farm Aid a lot, which in a way, maybe that's why this article is good and bad that we don't like talking about it as much. But it's Farm Aid. It's always Farm Aid. Remember Farm Aid? And oh, man. I mean, that's a huge lineup.
Yes.
So
massive.
I think what bothers me is just that like Farm Aid as an organization was designed to draw attention to the needs of small farmers and not to aid small farmers.
Mm. Well,
like they were like a promotional machine in and of themselves and not much more.
But you know, though, that's not uncommon.
It brings awareness.
Yeah, I know.
It brings awareness.
That's actually one of the things, maybe I shouldn't name any specific names, but like there's a lot of those like cancer awareness groups.
Yeah.
You give thousands and thousands and millions of dollars to a cancer awareness group. Guess what? They're not curing cancer. They're going out and handing out pamphlets about cancer awareness.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Especially since the fact that you can literally directly donate to cancer research groups.
Yeah.
Like they're not like advocating for cancer research. Like they actually employ scientists and doctors who are trying to treat and cure cancer.
Yep.
You can directly donate money to them. You don't need a middleman to do it.
So,
you don't need to walk
I think
10
was,
miles
there
to
was a
solve
time.
It.
There was a time when like cancer awareness as a means of like teaching people about self-examinations was a good idea, but that was 20 years ago, and now it's an excuse for a business that doesn't have to pay taxes to employ people that don't have enough skills to make it in the free market. We can move on.
I want this one.
Go for
real
it.
Real bad. 2003, on a day that will live in infamy.
I remember this day.
Who can forget this day?
I was sitting on my couch.
Ladies and gentlemen, where were you when you heard the news? During the third season of American Idol, the world got its first listen as he performed the classic song, She Bangs. Ladies and gentlemen, William Hung. She bang, she bang.
You know,
oh baby, when she moved.
That was actually better than his performance. That's the sad part.
Here's the thing.
No.
It spawned a semi-successful career for William Hung, who not only made it in at least one Super Bowl commercial, but also put out two more full-length albums of strictly covers, and he did okay. He did okay for himself.
I'd like to point out his actual name is Hung Hing Chung.
I think
Hung Hing Chung.
Hung Hing Chung. Well, William Hung, also a decent name.
Yes.
So
he was a civil engineering student, and then he became a singer, and apparently he's done some acting, and then he's now become a technical crime analyst.
He was somebody's house band.
He was. He like, was. Yes, like, he was on TV.
It was like a short-lived late-night interview show, and he was the house band. He was, he was the band leader, William Hung.
You know who I think? What I think William Hung really should do is host karaoke. That would be the perfect gig for him. And you know what, ladies and gentlemen? We've only got one interesting, amusing fact for this week.
The final fact of the night. And this is one that is near and dear to my heart.
Go for it. Pre-read, because there are typos in this first sentence.
Go ahead. 2015, happy birthday to you becomes public domain.
Yay.
Enters the public domain.
And ends an era of tyranny.
It does. Okay, so after lengthy lawsuits filed in 2013 by documentarian Jennifer Nelson, federal judge George H. King ruled that Happy Birthday to You had already been in the public domain for at least 8 years and may have never had the copyright to the song. And further, Warner Chappell Music had defrauded everyone they collected money from. It would be another 6 months of court proceedings with a class action lawsuit before $14 million in settlement was reached in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
Just
so, yeah.
Yeah.
There were like multiple copyrights from that, like 1920, 1922.
They kept suing
1926
anyone.
And 1930. And like Warner Chappell was trying to base everything on their 1930.
Yeah.
Copyright?
Yeah.
And the judge was like, look, this does not exist.
And even worse.
This is actually a fabrication that you bought. This copyright never existed.
They had a copyright on the lyrics?
Yes.
And the music?
Yes.
Which means that somebody actually couldn't like write a different version of Happy Birthday and then like cite it as their own. And you couldn't do the actual lyrics. It's one of the reasons why you never heard the song Happy Birthday sung in restaurants when the waiters came. And they always had to do that happy, happy birthday. Da, 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 da. Like they always did that kind of thing. So that's why. Because if they actually performed it, they had to pay somebody.
A lot. Probably,
yes.
Too.
And actually, the documentarian that they're talking about, I remember the documentary that they did. They got sued because they were filming a documentary and there was a scene with a family and it was the kid's birthday. Like that, one of the kid was in the documentary.
Oh, man.
And it was his birthday and they sang it to him for his birthday and they recorded it and they put it in the movie. And because of that, they sued them for like thousands of dollars. Just like it was really, really mm-hmm. over the top.
Wow.
And they were like, we're a small documentary like film company. We don't have that kind of money. It's like if you haven't noticed, all the music is like written by like Bob, who like
in accounting.
Runs the camera as well.
Yeah.
You know, and they were just like, we can't afford that, you know, but then they like through all of this other stuff. But yes, just the fact that they had to pay out $14 million in settlement. That makes me happy.
I'm sure I'm not the first person to say fuck you to Warner Chappell, but I sincerely hope I'm the last. I'm trying to exhort Warner Chappell to have more ethical business practice.
Yes.
So I have an idea, Brian.
What you got?
Well, I know that we're reached the end of our podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if maybe we'd all like to ingest one of these atomic sour warheads.
Yes,
the last minute of the show and see how it goes.
Greg and Jake have had these going since mm-hmm. we started. So I have not.
You
but
want one?
I'll go ahead and do it, and then I'll try to do the final read through.
Awesome. The lemon ones are the yellow ones are the
of course
lemon's the sourest. Okay,
yeah,
I'll do a lemon
they're
one.
The
with
most
you.
Punchy. Yeah.
All right, we're gonna end our podcast with super sour warheads in our mouths. Here
okay,
we go.
Okay, here we go. Oh, God. Welcome. I'm losing it.
It's so sour.
So, this has been Follow the Sound. This is really bad.
It's really sour.
That is the most sour thing I've ever had in my life.
This is Follow the Sound.
I really hope that you've enjoyed this program. If you would like to help out the show, of course, you can go to Amazon. You can go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. Do all your normal shopping. We get money. It's simple, stupid.
Blah, blah, blah. You know it.
But for me, Brian Croc, I have been your host. Along with me has been Jacob Crum.
A glint of steel, a flash of light, you know you're not going home tonight.
And Greg Harvey.
There are tears in my eyes. Thank you.
Remember, if you hear it, follow the sound.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.